Linoleum Knife,
a podcast of the cinema,
starring you, Alonso Duralde. You're the reviews editor of The Wrap. You're also the big deal film critic at The Wrap. Also, you're a co-host of What the Flick on the Young Turks Network. Also, you're a co-host of Who Shot Ya podcast on the Maximum Fun Network.
Thank you.
Also, yeah. It's your birthday.
Yesterday was my birthday.
2 days ago. Yesterday.
Yesterday.
What day is today?
It's all a blur now.
Saturday, but this is posting Sunday.
Right.
But correct.
It was for Friday, so it doesn't really matter.
Right.
And you're Dave White, and you write for The Wrap, and you co-host this show, and we were just on Press Play on KCRW, as we do every month. And
but not with Madeline Brand.
Sadly, no.
She was out gallivanting around.
Who knows where.
She was.
But it's always fun to go in. We have a lovely time.
Do you like my fascinator?
I'm fascinated by your love, boy.
No one gets that joke.
Really? No one?
No one remembers that song.
Okay.
Except gays of the 1980s.
Well, I think we have a few listening.
Maybe. Company B. Yep. Fascinated.
Yes.
Was the name of that club hit in the 1980s.
Not to be confused.
It's really good,
it is.
Too, by the way.
Not to be confused.
It holds up.
With fascinators, which become the topic of conversation every time there's a royal wedding.
I have a fascinator on right now. Yeah, do you see it?
You're holding a spoon up to the side of your head. I don't know that Philip Tracy would approve.
I was stirring my tea with this spoon.
Yes.
I think it's really funny that suddenly on Twitter again, everyone's like, a fascinator? What's that? Like, and people are making jokes about the name fascinator.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, okay, well, if you got a good joke, fine, give us the joke. But if you're just goofing on the fact that it's called a fascinator, that just means you're dumb.
Yeah.
Because they have been called fascinators forever.
Yeah.
It's not a word that someone just made up. This has been a kind of woman's hat since...
As long as there have been hats.
Yeah, for a long time. And so... Like, if you're like, oh, fascinator, no, don't be stupid. That's the name of the thing. Also, they're great. Fascinators are, let's agree, the best thing about the royal wedding or any fancy wedding.
I will not argue that.
Because you have cats like Philip Tracy out there making fascinators that look like they came from outer space.
Yes.
That's great.
Who doesn't like outer space?
Who doesn't like outer space, and who doesn't like things that look cool perched on top of a lady's head? Remember that time that Sarah Jessica Parker had a bird on her head in one of the Sex in the Cities?
Yeah.
Hence, that is a fascinator. And if you were walking past her and you looked at her, you'd be like, suddenly I'm fascinated.
Fascinated.
That lady has a bird on her head. Don't come at me with your fascinator jokes unless you're being funny.
Yeah. Keep it cut fresh.
Indeed.
You know, whenever
fascinate me with it.
Whenever I hear about Philip Tracy, it always makes you think of Christopher Tracy's parade.
I know.
It's just a thing. I can't
shake
it.
I know it's in your head. I know your brain and how it operates.
But look, at least I'm not thinking about, you know, songs from and inspired by Dick Tracy.
But you are often thinking about that. I know you are because I know you and because you have that album in your collection. I just organized the vinyl.
Wait, I have the Madonna album or I have the Dick Tracy soundtrack?
One of them.
I think I just have the Madonna album.
All I know is Breathless Mahoney is on the
right,
cover.
That's the Madonna album. That's I'm Breathless.
All right. Well, whatever.
But there was a whole separate album of the non-Madonna songs from and inspired by Dick Tracy.
What songs were in Dick Tracy besides the Madonna songs?
The only song that I remember from the other Madonna, the non-Madonna album, it was like Katie Lang and somebody doing a song called Riding the Rails that either was like an old sort of 1930s country song or was written to sound like one.
Oh, I see.
Beyond that, I got nothing. I have very vague memories about Dick Tracy in general. I saw that movie once when it opened, and never again.
Saw that movie more than most people saw that movie.
No, well, you know, it's weird. Well, here's the thing.
Was it a hit?
It was a hit.
It did. Okay.
And it's one of those things like Space Jam and Troop Beverly Hills, where the generation behind us thinks it was an important film and saw it a lot.
Well, generation behind us. I'm pleased that you like a thing. That movie was not good.
No.
It wasn't good then. It hasn't aged into being good. That's all. Hey, you want to close that shade behind you?
I would be happy to.
Because it's going to start. The June gloom of Southern California, which begins in May, and if we're lucky, stays through the end of June.
Yes.
Has decided this afternoon to break open and give us sunshine.
Boo.
You know I don't like that.
No.
We have, what I do like, is cinema.
Cinema Toast Crunch.
We went to that 2001 reissue last night.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Okay. I'm still a little vague about the whole provenance of this, but basically it's...
What are you vague about?
It's a new 70 print.
Yes.
Struck from the original camera negative.
Yes.
With no digital enhancement.
No fixes.
No
digital remastering or polishing of right. any sort.
It looked pretty great.
It's so
good. It looked at least as good as any other 70 screening of this movie that I've ever been to.
Nope.
And better than others, some of them. So, you know, because somebody on Facebook was saying, oh, well, the print looked terrible in the trailer that I saw. And does it look bad? I was like, no, it looks great. The colors are sharp and it's stunning. I mean, that's a movie, you know, there's nothing new to say about 2001, but I am forever just sort of gobsmacked that MGM
yeah.
in 1968
yeah. was like, they took that gamble. They were like, I guess the kids.
Okay.
I hear the kids are into this kind of thing now.
All right,
this
Stanley.
Is what's coming. They say this is what's coming.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I'm imagining this conversation in the boardroom, you know. But they rolled the dice and they did it right.
They're like, well, I mean, Dr. Strangelove and Spartacus were hits, so I guess.
Right.
Yeah. When we were leaving last night, I turned to Dave and I said, I'm trying to imagine, like, an Academy screening for this film, and Frank Sinatra is there.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, what you know, does he think you about? You know this? He was.
Yes, because look, this was 1968. If you've read Pictures from a Revolution about the 1967 Academy Awards that Mark Harris wrote, which is a great book, he talks about how you know we people often wonder how the heck did Dr. Doolittle, an unloved flop, managed to get a Best Picture nomination.
Right.
Apparently, 20th Century Fox had nightly screenings that would follow dinners where, like, prime rib and lobster and lots of champagne were served.
Oh, yeah.
So this was still the old school.
Put a pin in that story for a second. Don't put a pin in that story for a second, but let's go back to that reference when we talk about book club.
Oh, totally.
Okay.
But anyway, so this is like, you know, this is the old school times of how you promote movies to Academy members.
Right.
So I'm trying to remember, like, how do you get the fur coat and limo crowd into 2001? You know, the people who came up in the studio system, the people who remembered when MGM was actually run by Louis B. Mayer.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And, you know, are Sid Charisse and, you know, Ann Miller watching 2001?
They were. They all watched
John Ford. I mean,
they all watched it.
I'm just trying to imagine, like, anybody over the age of 35 in 1968 watching that movie.
The same way that 6 years later they were going to line up, or 5 years later they were all lining up to watch Deep Throat. they watched it. Yes.
I bet Deep Throat probably got played at a lot of house parties.
Oh, yeah.
you know,
of course it did.
People who had a theater in their home, but they didn't want to go to downtown.
Not going to that movie theater. Yeah. Of course, Deep Throat was playing in regular movie
theaters. No, it was. Yeah. It was. But I'm sure also, like, you know, again, Sid Charisse did not want to be photographed walking out of the screening of Deep Throat.
No.
But, you know, she did catch a screening at Mitzi Gaynor's house or something.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I'm making all of this up, but it all seems plausible.
You know, Mitzi Gaynor was like, hey, everybody.
You read about it in the New York Times.
This racy picture. We got a copy of it.
It's the future.
Come over.
It's the future of Hollywood.
Right.
It's what the young people are all about.
I'm going to kill his name. Bilge Ibiri, the film critic?
For the Village Voice.
Okay. That is a common male first name in Turkey. He's Turkish. He's a great film critic. I love reading him. And he wrote a piece for the Village Voice about this 70mm re-release of 2001. And the best part of it is when he tells the story about being taken to see it by his parents when he was 5 years old. He begged them to go see Star Wars. But he lived in Turkey, and Star Wars had not come there yet.
And Turkish Star Wars hadn't been made.
And neither had
yet.
Turkish Star Wars had also not yet been made. Go to YouTube and look that one up. Oh. It's there.
Strap in for Turkish Star Wars.
It's so good. But they took him to see 2001, and they said, yeah, this is Star Wars.
That is good parenting.
That is such awesome. That is such an awesome story. And he said he spent a year thinking that he had seen Star Wars, but he had seen 2001 instead. He was like 5, 6. Yeah,
I think 2001 and Jacques Tati's Playtime are about the only two movies that I will sort of
demand that see them on a big screen.
Well, no, that they see them in 70mm specifically. I think it makes a real difference in both those cases.
We saw it at the Arclight, which is really a wonderful venue for this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And we did the thing we never do. We sat on the front row.
Not the front row.
But the front row of the main section.
Yeah.
In front of the main section, there are two other rows for latecomers. That's really what those two rows are for. Oh, you're late? Sit down front.
Right.
Dummy.
It was a packed house, completely sold out.
Yeah.
Although no one sat next to me, which was nice.
It wasn't completely sold out. I'd say it was about 90% full, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a very respectful, quiet...
Silence. A silent
audience. That's a movie with some silences in it.
There are long sequences of silence in that film. And I mean, like... a vacuum of sound, like the kind of silence that makes you think, did something go wrong with the sound?
Is the air being pumped out of this room?
Yeah. So good. Ugh. I've seen that movie so many times, and I could just keep seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
I love it that much.
Yeah.
Everything about it. Just the meticulous detail, just the immersive quality of it, the simultaneous terror and ecstasy of it.
It takes such big narrative chances, and we've sort of collectively decided that we're okay with it because we all kind of think we know what it means.
Right.
But I can't imagine having been being a critic in 1968, being one of the first people to see this movie, and having like 24 hours to write a review of it. And it just makes me wonder, like, if there are movies now where... you know, I'm not going to get them for decades, you know. It's just a thing you have to live with.
Well, we're finally going to talk about You Were Never Really Here today, and that may be a movie I don't get, but we'll get to that in a second.
Right.
I just, you know, 2001 was this film that blew my little mind when I was like 9 or 10 years old, whenever it got a re-release in the mid-70s, and it was rated G.
Oh, yeah.
And so I skipped the kid matinee that weekend. And I I got dropped off for 2001.
There's a list online, you've seen it, of like 15 movies you won't believe are rated G.
Yeah.
And it was like the original Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Romeo and Juliet with like the nudity, the Zeffirelli version.
Yeah, because it's Shakespeare. They're like, you're not going to give Shakespeare anything but a general audience rating. Yeah.
Right.
It was just the most perfect moment of my childhood because I was practically alone or fully alone in the theater, and my memory is that I was fully alone.
Hmm.
And because, you know, it was like a Sunday afternoon matinee of a movie that had been out for, you know, 6 or 8 years or something like that. And I had no idea what was going on, but I knew I was watching something like incredible.
Yeah.
And that last section, which blows everyone's mind, I just remember thinking, I want to stay and see it again. Like, I want to stay and watch this again right now, even though I have no idea what's going on. And I'd say in the first hour of the film, I was confused and maybe getting a little bored.
Because
I thought, I don't know what's happening, and seemingly nothing is happening. But I knew I had to keep watching, and then, boy, it pays off.
Well,
at the end.
You know, the last time I saw this movie in Los Angeles in 70mm,
yes.
Somebody had such an intense reaction to the Stargate sequence that they had
Beyond the Infinite?
Yes. They had to stop the film and bring the lights up and sort of physically remove him. And then they rewound it and started again. But if you look on YouTube for like 2001 Freakout.
Is it still there?
It might be.
I'm looking it up right now to see if it's still there.
And I was taking a friend of ours who had never seen the film before.
Yeah.
And he was already kind of like, you know, wigged out by it. And so that extra element of...
6 minutes and 43 seconds, posted 5 years ago, titled Stargate Chaos. At the Hollywood Egyptian Theater during a screening of 2001 A Space Odyssey. Yeah, someone had a meltdown, like a panic attack or something. And we don't know, we'll never know why.
Right.
But, yeah, you were there.
Mm-hmm. Unforgettable.
So we're catching up for some things this week and...
Seeing new things as well.
Yeah, we're going to talk about You Were Never Really Here. We're going to talk about Super Troopers 2, and then this week's new things, Book Club,
Deadpool 2,
First Reformed. So, I'm gonna give you 60 seconds of Super Troopers 2.
Okay. Which I didn't see.
Which you have missed, and you're going to have to wait until DVD, because even though it was a hit... By its budget standards, like it cost $10 or $12 million to make,
which was mostly crowdfunded, I think,
and it just immediately doubled that and made it back. Like it's a profitable film,
right?
Although it wasn't a huge hit because the original wasn't a huge hit. This is the definition of a cult film.
It's the reason it took 10 years to get a sequel.
Longer than 10 years, like 16, 17 years.
Oh goodness,
okay. Yeah. The original Super Troopers about the dumb cops in the northern Vermont.
I think. Yeah.
Who bust a drug ring? An idiotic film that I love with all of my heart.
Oh God, yes. That was that's one of those screening moments I always remember because we saw
there's a reason to remember it.
Yeah. We saw it on the Fox lot and it was literally being shown to three people.
Uh-huh. You, me, and
Kevin Thomas of the LA Times, who
hated it so much.
Yeah.
He was sighing.
He was audibly sort of groaning. So the two sounds you could hear during the screening were him audibly groaning and Dave and me howling with laughter, which I'm sure just made him madder.
Well, bless his heart.
Yes.
Anyway, we've seen the original Super Troopers many, many times.
Yeah.
Shown it to unsuspecting friends who, when it's over, either love it as much as we do or say, I don't get what you think is so funny about this.
I don't get your generation's humor.
So this one is, it's more of the same, only a little bit less of the same.
Yeah.
The guys are now in Canada, and they have to work with some Canadian Mounties. Something, something, bad guys reasons. Okay. I laughed consistently throughout this film.
Okay.
There are old gags that come back, and you want them to come back.
Sure.
And there are new gags that are just as idiotic as the first film.
Is Christina Hendricks' husband in this one?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. And, but, you know, Rob Lowe is.
Why not?
Yeah. And so, the funniest bit in the film is also the most true and real bit in the film. And it doesn't matter that I'm going to spoil it, because it's a thing that everyone already knows is true, but they've never admitted it. The Canadians in the film mock the Americans for how we say the word that is spelled S-O-R-R-Y.
Ah.
All right. And they do it in such a jubilant, we finally are going to...
It's our turn.
Where it's our turn to get you for this word. Because the American joke, the people in the United States who joke about the way Canadians talk immediately go to the sorry.
Sorry and dollar.
Sorry, yeah. And then the Canadians are like, sorry, sorry, sorry. In the film. And you're like, oh.
We had it coming.
A, we have it coming. B, they're right. Because think about this.
S-O-R.
S-O-R. S-O-R-E is pronounced sore.
Yeah.
What are you sore about? Is that sore? Your arm, is it sore? What's that thing in your face? A sore?
A gaping sore?
There is no good reason for the people in the United States to pronounce S-O-R-R-Y as sorry. As
it
though
should
that,
be sorry.
As though that A were an O. Or as though that O were an A.
Right.
It should be sorry. Canadians pronounce that word correctly. And it took this film showing me that to finally make it real to me. I was like, oh, wait. You guys are right.
It does not excuse dollar, though, because D-O-L-L is still doll.
True. Yeah, y'all crazy for that. Anyway, this movie's completely stupid. And I had a good time.
Okay.
And that is as far as criticism should even touch the world of Super Troopers.
Right.
Because there's no point to... These movies are about nothing. Except people pulling each other's pants down. You know, like, it's not...
The weird thing is, like, as much as I loved Super Troopers, I've never really gone out of my way to see any of the other Broken Lizard movies.
Most of them are not good. Like, Beerfest is funny.
Okay, but I didn't see Slammin' Salmon. I caught about half of Club Dread on
Club cable. Dread is terrible.
Well, I do like, what's Bill Paxton's like hit song? Is it like Margarita Town or something?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
it's all mad that Jimmy Buffett stole it.
Yeah.
You know, I Puddle Jumper, I recall being fairly funny. That's the one they made before.
Right.
Which I saw at Sundance, of all places. But yeah, somehow my affection for that movie never quite carried into the other stuff. And then it's weird, like, you know, Jay Chandrasekhar, let's never forget, directed the Dukes of Hazzard
movie. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did. One disappointment. His character from the first film is in this film, obviously. But him being a bisexual swinger is not mentioned in this film.
Oh.
And I was kind of hoping for more
mustache ride
dirty stuff
again
on that front, because that, along with the Jackass films, felt like a very bold push toward like opening up the idea of sexuality in comedy without being like freaked out about it.
Yeah, the idea that like that your hero, the dude that you are supposed to be relating to and identifying with, and you know, even is aspirational.
Yeah,
like,
well, there's no, you're not aspiring to be okay, anyone, but you know, Super Troopers.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, we, the guy you like, the guy you think is funny, the guy you think is cool, like, also, like, clearly, you
has,
know,
sex
has sex with dudes,
has sex with men. Yes.
That was daring.
So anyway, it'll be streaming here in about 5 minutes, probably. Gotcha. So if you look, don't see it if you haven't seen the first one,
right?
Because the first one is a masterpiece.
Don't you forget it, Meow.
Right. You were never really here.
Yes.
I finally went after much foot dragging.
Mm-hmm.
To see You Were Never Really Here this week. It is still playing at the Los Feliz 3.
A theater that was very obviously once the Los Feliz 1.
Yeah.
Because all three theaters are carved into these weird angles.
Weird-shaped little boxes.
Yeah.
And like, rows that stop and start irregularly. Like, you're kind of weaving your way through an aisle to get... It's the... Each theater holds about 30 people. The screens are way high up on the wall. Like, no matter where you're sitting, you're kind of looking up at the screen.
Yeah.
It is a strange little theater.
It's like one of those Soviet apartments where they just took somebody's really big apartment and just like divided it up.
Haphazardly carved it into something else. But I'll tell you something. I still like that theater because it's totally independently run.
Yes.
And they know their neighborhood so well that I bet they never go out of business. Yeah. Because
don't they have Mommy and Me matinees there?
I don't know.
I'm just trying to imagine the Mommy and Me matinee if You Were Never Really Here.
But they were showing that. They were showing You Were Never Really Here, like the last theater in the metro Los Angeles area to be showing it.
Mm-hmm.
Isle of Dogs, Tully, and the Grace Jones documentary.
Okay.
Yeah. So Isle of Dogs.
That's a demo.
Isle of Dogs and the Grace Jones documentary sharing a screen.
Right.
Like an abbreviated schedule. But I was like, oh, this is exactly what this theater should be showing for this neighborhood.
Los Feliz is...
For the story that this neighborhood likes to tell about itself.
Exactly.
But it's clear...
It's surrounded by many coffee houses.
It's clear that it's the perfect thing because...
They're still open.
A Tuesday afternoon
mm-hmm.
to see You Were Never Really Here, and it was a full theater.
All 30 seats were taken?
Yeah. Which surprised me. I thought I'd be more or less alone.
Right.
But it was full. So this movie is from Lynn Ramsey.
Right.
Many of you who are listening have probably already seen it. Joaquin Phoenix plays a traumatized hitman.
And you, veteran.
You know he's a hitman because you know he's traumatized because they show you flashbacks of him in a warlike situation. Well, not a warlike situation, but a war.
And also of
and childhood abuse. Yes, you see flashbacks of that. His job now is to be a moody, suicidal. He's had suicidal ideations, like, from childhood,
mm-hmm.
and continues to have them.
He operates in the shadows.
And he is a hitman whose job is to rescue young girls who are being sex trafficked.
Is that all that he does?
Well, that might not be all that he does, but that's all that he does in this film.
Yes, that's true.
All right. So there's a girl who's missing. She's a senator's daughter. The timeline is a little strange because they say she didn't come home this weekend. She's like 13.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's been missing all weekend. And yet by the time he finds her, her behavior is odd. She doesn't seem panicked. She doesn't seem freaked out. She seems numbed.
To her surroundings.
To her surroundings after what, like 72 hours? And I didn't get that, but that's only one of this film's, for me, problems. I don't want to spoil what happens, but he finds her fairly quickly, but learns that there's so much more going on
right
around her circumstances. And it just gets uglier and darker and more despairing and more desperate and more
futile.
Yeah. The feeling of futility hangs over this film. And it is... I was right to drag my feet. It is one of the more agonizing films I've seen in a bit.
And yet, less of a slog than We Need to Talk About Kevin, her previous mm-hmm. film.
I am pro Lynn Ramsey. I like her work.
I've seen Ratcatcher, but yes. Not Morvern Caller. Mm.
That's great.
Okay.
I don't know how I feel about this film. Something in my gut made me drag my feet to see it, and now that I've seen it, I am having mixed, conflicted feelings, sometimes ambivalent about it. Part of me thinks that there's not much there. The other half of me thinks that she's, you know, made this rigorous exploration of grief and emptiness. I mean, the title alone suggests emptiness.
Right.
And that's not fun to watch on the best of days. So I'm not quite sure what I'm thinking right now.
Well, this is neither...
I keep thinking about it, so yeah. That's something.
This is neither here nor there. This is one of those movies where it premiered at Cannes last year.
Yes.
And then she went back and re-edited.
Oh, did she?
Yeah. Like, the version that's playing theatrically now is a different cut than what premiered last year.
Okay.
For better or for worse. My takeaway was, to me, I felt like she was, it was almost along the lines of something like Funny Games, where she is making an action movie, but taking out all the sort of the fun parts, you know, and leaving you right. with, you know, morally questionable people committing morally questionable acts.
Well, some of them are not even morally questionable. Some of them are just immoral.
Absolutely. Yes, I didn't mean to imply otherwise. But yeah. what I'm saying, though, is it takes out the sort of the exhilarating parts of an action movie.
Of a genre film that's like an exploitation movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
leaves you with the sort of ugly, you know... backdrop.
The ugly, ugly everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ugly, I mean...
Because everything is ugly.
Yeah, here. not just the sort of horror of, you know, trafficking and that kind of thing, but also the sort of blankness of the action hero who's called upon to do this stuff.
Right.
And the people who call upon him to do it, and they, you know, it's taking away the sort of adrenaline, the adrenaline, and leaving you to deal with the dark underbelly
right.
of that kind of film.
The human behavior in this film is also so stylized that I had a hard time wondering if Lynn Ramsey actually cared about the people in the film.
Interesting.
I found it, it's upsetting. And I'm glad there was a pastry waiting for me at the end at the little coffee shop next door. I'm not going to say that I don't take this seriously, because she clearly takes this film seriously, or she wouldn't have made it.
Right.
But
you're not clear about what the point of it
was. I'm not clear what I'm supposed to think other than misery.
Right.
How am I supposed to, what am I supposed to think about this film other than, oh, that was miserable and now I'm miserable?
Heaven knows you're miserable now.
Right.
I don't even know really how to answer that question.
Perhaps someday I'll see it again and think about it differently.
It's a movie that, like, I'm glad that I saw it, but at the same time, I didn't come away with it with any sort of strong ideas of, ah, well, clearly she meant to say blah, 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 you know.
Right. Yeah, that ambiguity is baked in.
Yes.
Okay, Deadpool 2.
If you like Deadpool 1...
You'll like Deadpool 2.
Here's another one.
Maybe. I liked Deadpool 1 just fine.
Yes. And I like this one just fine, too.
I think I like it less than just fine, but you go on. Talk about what it is.
I don't like it as much as the first one, but part of the problem is that it doesn't really try to go beyond the first one. So it is another movie where, you know, Ryan Reynolds is playing this very sarcastic, very self-aware to the point of, you know, breaking the fourth wall and making kind of meta jokes about the film itself and about other superhero franchises and other Ryan Reynolds movies and what have you. A terrible thing happens and Deadpool is left depressed and sleeping on the couch at Professor Xavier's School for Exceptional Children and winds up getting drawn into this thing with the X-Men involving a little kid with mutant powers who is in this creepy sort of rehab facility run by Eddie Marzan. It's very kind of a pray the gay away, but for mutants. And then along comes Josh Brolin as Cable, a time-traveling manhunter who wants to kill this kid for future reasons. And so Deadpool finds himself sort of having to care about something and someone and
right.
coming to the kid's rescue.
Yeah. I'm just going to say it. I was bored.
Really?
I was bored.
Okay.
I was bored. I laughed a couple times. I was going to be a little nicer by saying I liked it a little less than the first one, but I don't see why this has any reason to exist. it advanced some plot line stuff a little bit, but the jokes were predictably Deadpool-ish.
Yeah,
half a dozen of them made me laugh. The rest of the time, I just sat there watching it, thinking, "Okay, well, I see it. I see that is a joke. You just made a joke, and I don't care. I don't care about this movie. I was bored by this movie. The end. Yeah.
It is a brand of humor that I think is a cousin to problems that I had with Solo, which we'll talk about next week, mm-hmm. which is that sort of there's a general thing about fanboy media that is designed to let people be proud of themselves for getting a reference.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure that kind of thing has existed in literature throughout. I'm sure there were people who read, you know, sonnets and were, you know, proud of themselves for knowing the mythological reference of, you know, Athena or whatever, you know, like there's something about that thing. And so they traffic in that a lot with Deadpool. You know, they traffic in you knowing the X-Men movies and you right. knowing Ryan Reynolds' film career and you right. knowing.
And I know enough about all of those things to get all the jokes.
Yeah, comic book stuff in general, you know.
Yes.
Whether or not those jokes are then also actually funny is a separate, you know, issue.
I've gone on a journey for the past couple days from thinking this was fine.
Mm-hmm.
This was funny enough. The person on Twitter who said it was Minions for adults was like, okay, yeah, that's fine. And I like the Minions and I like Deadpool and that's fine. And let's all see it and have a good time and go about our business.
Right. But the further away from
Further away from it, the more I think, no, screw it. This is boring. Yeah, it's not interesting. It's not even all that funny.
I have to say, while I was watching it, I kept waiting for it to be better. But I still, and you know, I did go back and watch Deadpool a second time, like on a plane once, just to right. sort of confirm that it actually worked for me. And it
yeah.
did. And I'm glad I saw it again. I still laughed. I still enjoyed it. I don't know that I'm ever going to circle back and watch this again. Even though there are some things in there that I enjoyed. I like Zazie Beetz.
Yes.
She's yes. very fun as Domino.
She's fun, yeah. Leslie Uggams delivers my favorite line in the movie. I won't mm-hmm. spoil it, but she says the funniest thing, I think, in the film.
There are a couple of gags that I thought, like, all right, well, that's a different thing that we're going with, and that's kind of funny, you know, the regeneration of his legs.
Yeah. Yeah, that was not bad.
Yeah, but yeah, you're right. It's not really a movie that needs to exist.
And if you're not going to get with Colossus, then stop teasing me.
Yeah, I know. There's all, you know.
Don't give me your junket press interview where you're like, oh, Deadpool's pansexual.
Well, and
blah, blah, and blah. Okay, well then do it.
In the comics,
get Ant-Man and Colossus. I need a three-way.
I think in the comics they actually do go there, and in the movies they don't. However, they do give Negasonic Teenage Warhead a girlfriend, which is more than most superhero movies bother to do.
That's
on the queer scale.
She pops in with the girlfriend three times.
Yes.
The girlfriend does nothing except wave and say hello.
Yeah.
Negasonic Teenage Warrior herself is Warhead is given nothing to do until the very end.
Yeah.
And even then, it's not much.
No.
So she's sort of sidelined throughout most of the film.
I like Eddie Marzan. I like Rob Delaney.
Yes. I like Rob Delaney.
But he
makes me laugh. I'm happy that he's in this film.
It's a bit on the whatever scale. But again, if you are a big fan of Deadpool, you're not going to walk away from this movie annoyed by it.
Disappointed or annoyed.
Yeah.
Because you already know what you want.
Exactly.
And it'll give it to you.
But I think superhero movies all sort of tend to be of a piece with each other. But comedies, if you're going to make a sequel to a comedy, I think you are expected to somehow top yourself. And this movie doesn't do it. And then there's Book Club.
Why don't you and I are not of the same mind on this.
No.
We thought we were going to be going in.
Yeah.
And because the trailer is god-awful.
Yes.
The trailer made me think, oh, I'm never seeing this.
The key art is terrible.
The trailer made me think I'm never seeing this, and then we had to go see it.
Right.
So that we could talk about it on KCRW.
Yes.
So we go, and here's the second warning, the second red flag. Free booze at the press screening.
We all got a coupon for
free
beer or wine.
Drinks. Yeah.
It's like, oh, brother, why don't you just hit us all in the head with a hammer?
This film stars Jane Fonda and Diane Keaton and Mary Steenburgen and Candace Bergen as four older women who have had a book club going since the 1970s. Jane Fonda is the one who never married or had children, and she is the one who does sex all the time and who wears animal prints and who makes... And who has, since the 1970s, made this book club read racy books. She made them read Erica Jong's Fear of Flying in the 1970s. You have to be old to even remember what that was or why it means something to this character. So you know who this movie is for.
Yes.
People our age and older.
Right.
So she trots out 50 Shades of Grey for them to read like it's 2013 and we're all doing the Harlem Shake. Like, why is this happening? And another why that I had was, why, if you've been making them read racy things since the 1970s and you all read Fear of Flying, wouldn't you look at 50 Shades of Grey...
And roll your eyes.
Wouldn't you see... What it was, why wouldn't you see it immediately for what it was, which is Twilight fan fiction, bizarrely reactionary.
Written badly.
Twilight fan fiction written badly that prioritizes this heteronormative monogamy and marriage and equates an affinity for sexual kink with psychological trauma.
Yeah.
But instead keeps masquerading as this pro-BDSM kink fest. That should not phase these characters one bit. It should instead make them go, what the hell is going on with this book choice?
Yeah, if these were like four sheltered housewives in Indiana.
Right.
You
but
know,
these are sophisticated, LA intelligent ladies. Women in Los Angeles who have at least intellectually progressive sexual sensibilities.
And no shade on Indiana. There are certainly sheltered housewives in, you know, Orange County who are in the same boat. But yeah, these four...
There are sheltered people everywhere.
Exactly.
Okay.
These four characters...
We don't need to even gender it.
Yes, that too. these four characters are too... These four characters are too smart for that book, and these four actresses are way too good for this terrible script.
Yeah. Continue.
So, and as somebody pointed out, they're basically the Sex and the City gals.
Right.
Jane Fonda is the Samantha. Candace Bergen is the Miranda, down to the fact that she's a judge.
Right.
Mary Steenburgen is the Charlotte, and Diane Keaton, who actually narrates, is the Carrie.
Right.
And, you know, when the movie has the four of them sitting around, you know, drinking rosé and talking about stuff, that's the best part. Like, there's my favorite scene in the movie is toward the end, where they're all sort of lamenting their romantic woes, and the other three of them are calling out each one of them for why she's getting in her own way.
Right.
And why she's being her own problem, which is a thing that old friends do.
Yes.
And can do.
Without it becoming a third act, you know, stumbling block.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Oh, now my feelings are...
Now we're not friends anymore.
You know, no, this is a conversation that you can have and that only these people can have with each other.
Right.
But the rest of the movie is just such a hacky collection of... nothing. I mean, Mary Steenburgen is a restaurateur and she's married to Craig T. Nelson, and there's no spark in their sex life, so she like crushes Viagra and puts it in his beer, waka waka. Diane Keaton is kind of getting swept off her feet by Andy Garcia, who always looks like he's wearing an ascot, whether he's wearing one or not.
Right.
And they have chemistry, but the dialogue they have is dumb, and she's saddled with this whole dumb subplot about how her adult daughters think that she is, you know, not capable of living on her own, and they want to like shut her up in a basement in Arizona somewhere. Don Johnson plays an ex of Jane Fonda's, and they have zero chemistry, and their quips back and forth are awful, to the point where one of them says some asinine witticism and the other one says cute, which is the last refuge of the bad writer. It reminded me of all those episodes of My Mother, the Car I sat through for Cancel Too Soon, where they would do that. And then on top of it, they get the courtship between Jane Fonda and Don Johnson on a rooftop, and between Diane Keaton and Andy Garcia in a prop plane, involve the worst green screen you've ever seen. Like, worse than The Room. Plus the terrible Photoshop picture of the four of them at the beginning of the movie.
Multiple terrible Photoshop pictures of them. Yeah.
Yeah, with their copies of Fear of Flying. It's like, oh.
I didn't buy the Diane Keaton's daughters trying to pull her off to Arizona bit at all. Like, she's clearly not disabled.
Yeah.
She's clearly not in any need of any sort of, you know, help. We're not given a reason for the daughters to be worried about her. And the conversation could have been squashed with Diane Keaton just looking at him being like, have you seen my house?
Yeah.
I have a kick-ass house. I have a big, beautiful, gorgeous house here in Los Angeles where I get to go out and do things, fun things with my friends all the time.
I never walk out the door not dressed like Diane Keaton.
Right. Yeah. Like, look at this is where all my hats are. I can't fit all my hats in your house, in your basement room in Arizona. I have so many damn hats. I wear them in the pool. Like
at night.
At night. Cause I'm Diane Keaton. It's.
And I get why.
Right.
This is actually even more so than Grace and Frankie, because Grace and Frankie, I think, does acknowledge certain physical and mental issues that older women face in a more realistic way.
No, it absolutely does.
This is definitely this fantasy.
And I don't even
like
that show.
this is a fantasy of like, I'm in my 70s, I'm sexually viable, my hips work, I can see well enough to drive. I'm sharp as a tack, like all these things that for a lot of people, you know, are aspirational or maybe aren't going to be the case anymore.
Right.
And so I get that fantasy. I love the fact that a movie exists with these four women's names above the title.
Yes.
But that only takes me so far in forgiving its many, many shortcomings.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so here's what I liked. That in spite of the terrible premise, they didn't dwell on the book very much.
Thankfully.
On the 50 Shades thing very much. They only use it as a jumping off point for what the movie is really about. And I don't even know if the script knows it, but it's a film about female friendship.
Yeah. Well, Mary Steenburgen brings it up more than the rest of them do.
True, but... because she wants sex. Yeah. Okay. But you're right. It's full of hacky jokes, embarrassingly boring writing. But you do come away from it believing that these women have known and loved each other for a very, very long time.
Sure.
That's all due to the sort of lovely on-screen abilities of all four of them. Each one of them gets a moment in the film to show that they are still actors. Yes. Who are capable at their jobs and who are doing their best to do something more than what the film sets up for them.
I liked Bergen's date with Richard Dreyfuss a lot.
Yep, that's a great scene. Mary Steenburgen's tap dancing scene near the end is great. Diane Keaton's talk about her first kiss is great. They all move beyond it. Like, whatever is presented for them to do, they move beyond it. Seemingly all four of them knowing that this script is kind of BS, it's limited, and that they can surpass those limits. So I am glad this film exists. It's not good, but it's, you know, what it wants to be emerges in fits and starts. And therefore, I walked out of it thinking, okay, well, I don't hate it. It's not rotten. I've seen rotten movies.
I suppose.
This one's just bleh, with people in it, people starring in it, who are, like, miles ahead of the actual film they're in.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I guess weirdly a part of me thinks we should support this movie so that they make more like them and they make a good one.
I just did.
But
I just did support this movie by telling you that it's not a pile of stink.
It's definitely a take your mom movie.
Right.
If you've got a mom that you take the movies, take her to this one.
Yep. First Reformed.
Yes. Now, it's funny. I saw this movie last August, September, whenever, at the Venice Film Festival. And, you know, even though I was like 8 or 9 hours ahead of Dave White, I immediately texted him. I was like, oh my God, this movie is Diary of a Country Priest.
Please proofread my review, see if I'm getting it right.
Because I can't write about this movie without talking about Diary of a Country Priest, and I need you to make sure that I'm getting all my Diary of a Country Priest facts in order.
Yes.
Because... if you're new to this program, you may not know, but Dave White is a big stan for Robert Bresson, the French filmmaker who was a huge influence on writer-director Paul Schrader, who was a film critic before he was a director, and wrote the sort of seminal text, Transcendentalism in Film, Ozu, Bresson, Dreyer.
Yep.
And
yeah, you could call me a stan.
You are.
Yeah.
And so this is a movie about a country priest who keeps a diary.
A country priest, country, more like suburban. He's in a small town. In upstate New York. The church is a tourist church. It's not a thriving neighborhood congregation.
Yeah, it had been a stopping point for the Underground Railroad.
Yeah.
And so the building basically exists as a tourist site. And he holds sermons services every Sunday, but yeah,
like it's, 5 people show
exactly.
Up. Yeah, one of those people is Amanda Seyfried, who is with a husband who
she's pregnant.
She's pregnant. Her name is Mary. There's a lot of symbolism going on here. She has a husband who is
despairing about bringing a child into.
He's an environmental activist, and he wants her to have an abortion because he cannot fathom the idea of bringing a child into a world that could actually be unfit for human habitation by the time that child is middle-aged.
Yeah.
And that's a fact.
He's not wrong.
He's not wrong. And so... things happen.
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't want to go into everything
best
that happens.
You discovered on your own.
You should discover it on your own. Things happen. And the most important thing, though, is that Ethan Hawke's minister, and this is a denomination is never mentioned. Mm-hmm. He's not a priest.
Right.
He's a minister of a Protestant denomination.
He had been married He had a child who died.
And the child died. The wife left him. And he is...
Well, child. He had a son who died in the Iraq War.
Yeah. He has a deep crisis of... Not a crisis of his faith, because he holds fast to having faith. But the crisis is, what is he going to do with it?
Right.
He is contrasted by a megachurch in the nearby area that is pastored by, what's Cedric the Entertainer's real last name?
I forget. Cedric Kyles. Yeah. Which, if you'll recall, Schrader in 1978 cast Richard Pryor in Blue Collar, mm-hmm. which was the first time that anybody had put him in a dramatic role. And yep. And Cedric is as much of a revelation in this, I would say, as Richard Pryor was in that film, in terms of this is a completely straight part, and mm-hmm. he's quite dynamic.
Yeah, it's he his character, and most of the other people in the film treat Ethan Hawke's character as though he is this ineffectual, you know, person that needs to be tended and patted on the head and
yeah.
and stuff like that. Very much like the priest in Diary of a Country Priest, who is not respected by the local parish. She's not taken seriously. And the crisis of his faith becomes, in the film's world, a really damning and mournful rebuke of contemporary evangelical Christianity. The audience for the contemporary evangelical Christian filmmaking wave will not see this film.
Oh, God, no.
Other than to perhaps be offended by it, and so that they can report to their friends.
Right. Yeah, you know, we talk a lot about faith-based films, and you always say that the reason that so many of them are so terrible is because they drove their artists away.
They did.
This is an actual film about faith from a genuine artist.
Uh-huh.
And so, but yeah, it is not going to play to the God's Not Dead crowd, but
nope.
I think it will.
Because they'll be mad at it.
But it will play yeah. to people who respect and appreciate Paul Schrader and have wondered if he was ever going to make another movie that was right. this good.
Right. And he has.
Yes.
This is the best thing he's made in, since when?
I mean, I didn't see Affliction. A lot of people love that one. You know, I thought Light Sleeper was great.
Yeah.
I will defend The Canyons, but this is a leaps
well,
and bounds
The Canyons
beyond.
Is a strange, small film.
Yeah.
This is a major work
yes.
from him.
It definitely, the character, I think, you know, when at the USA Film Festival, my first year as programmer there in 95, we honored Paul Schrader's career, and he asked that we screen what he called the Night Trilogy,
yeah.
which was Taxi Driver, American Gigolo, and Light Sleeper. And
yeah.
he sort of sees all of those characters as being kind of the same character.
Well, they... Yeah, and so is this one. Yeah.
That's where I was going.
Yeah.
This is a character who I think very much, you know, it's very easy to draw a line from Travis Bickle to Ethan Hawke's minister in this film.
Oh, without a doubt.
And Ethan Hawke is extraordinary.
He's great. He's great. It's troubling. It's upsetting in much different ways than You Were Never Really Here.
I think it's an ending that's going to prompt a lot of conversation.
Uh-huh. And, you know, for the man who wrote a book about transcendence in film, this film is really actively striving toward that state.
Yeah.
If you have seen The Diary of a Country Priest, you will pat yourself on the back for noticing things that are lifted directly from it.
So this is the Deadpool 2
this
for
is the Deadpool
Diary
2
of a Country Priest fans.
Of Diary of a Country Priest fans. Same as Bergman's Winter Light, Wise Blood, which all three of them visually and thematically inform this one. I think this is really great. We can, I don't know, if someone wants to talk about Schrader's recent tweets, we can do that someday.
Oh, dear.
Listen, he and Claire Denis should go to lunch together and have someone with them.
I was going to say, maybe with somebody.
To teach them about how to be on Twitter.
Yeah.
How to say things like in public. Like, I don't know what's going on with the generation of older filmmakers. And why they can't hold competing thoughts in their head at the same time.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay. I just remembered the Schrader thing.
Yeah. Like, he, listen, he just made a great movie.
Yes.
Just don't follow him on Twitter, because sometimes the things he says most recently are like, you want to bonk him in the head. Like, snap out of it. Don't become this guy.
Yeah.
Maybe you've always been this guy. Man. Only Mary Beth Hurt knows.
I suppose. What's your DVD pick?
Oh, that's a... It's Alive box. All three It's Alive movies.
Now on Blu-ray.
In one beautiful box. There's only one thing wrong with the Davis baby. It's Alive. The one movie you should not see alone. God, I love It's Alive. I even like It's Alive, too. And the reason I'm keeping this box set around for a while is because I've never seen Island of the Alive.
The Alive, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, but it's on. Triple feature. Next time I'm sick or something, I don't know. It'll sit on Mount Unwatched for a bit, but they'll get to it.
Mine is also a box set. It is season 11 of Mystery Science Theater 3000. First time these episodes or episodes of this show have ever been available on Blu-ray. And so if you're not a Netflix person, or you are still, or just a completist for MST and like to have things on physical media, because you never know when the streaming version is going to go away. This has all 14 episodes of the newest season. And they're great. And I think they've really managed to sort of keep the magic there. You know, Joel Hodgson's back, but now he's got Jonah Ray hosting, and Elliot Kalin from The Flophouse and Daily Show is their new head writer. And Patton Oswalt's in there, and Felicia Day, and a lot of the original cast pops up here and there in cameos. It's a lot of fun. And so if you are a fan, you'll want to hang on to it.
Letters. Marissa says, thank you so much for making a wonderful podcast. I came to you from Pop Rocket.
Oh, yay.
Well, golly. That always makes me happy.
Yeah.
When people come to us through appearances in other places, mm-hmm. I think, well, that was time not wasted then. Listen. If no one ever came to us from Pop Rocket, just the fact that I got to be on Pop Rocket, yes, a few times.
That was a delight.
That was a treat in its own. That was worth the time. God, I love Pop Rocket so much. You guys, are you listening to Pop Rocket? Because if you aren't, they're better than us.
Oh, it's a different experience, but you should be listening to
them. Better than us. Okay, so... she says she now listens to Who Shot You and Switchblade Sisters, oh, too.
Well, all right, then.
Well.
All the fifth Beatles.
Marissa, you're our new favorite person. Thank you for all the recommendations. As someone who drug two different friends to showing of Ex Libris when it was shown in two theaters in Boston weeks apart. I consider myself a pretty prolific movie fan, and I picked most of my most recent apartment due to its proximity to the indie theater in my city. Now that you're my kind of person. Yeah. However, I have a knowledge. Every time I drive past a cool little independent film theater, like an art house, mm-hmm. I think, what if I lived around the block? Like, I'd just walk there and just go to whatever I wanted to anytime. Like, it was just, what a great little neighborhood that would be. Yeah.
We're close to things.
We are close to things. Mostly to food. Which is my second favorite.
Well, sure.
No, that's actually my first favorite.
Be real.
Food, sleep, doing it, movies.
Cinema.
Yeah. Top five. Cinema's top five.
Absolutely.
It's my career, after all.
No question.
Yeah. However, I have a knowledge gap when it comes to films that came out before my adult years. Think pre-2000.
Oh.
On your advice, I got a Filmstruck account with the Criterion Collection, nice. And I'm so excited. After a binge of all the John Waters and Godzilla movies, I'm overwhelmed by what to pick next. I made a watch list by browsing all the films alphabetically and have 55 movies to watch. While that's not necessarily a problem, I was wondering if you had any must-see films that I might have missed. Even looking at my list, I can tell I'm skewing pretty white and English language. Any advice would be appreciated.
Well, yeah, we just kind of took a browse through. I mean, I find the groupings are really helpful. Like right now on Filmstruck.
Oh, they really are.
Yeah, they're doing this series of like journalism films that goes all the way from like Five Star Final and His Girl Friday through Face in the Crowd and Ace in the Hole and Sweet Smell of Success all the way up to like All the President's Men and Network. So that's really cool. Yeah. If you're looking for less white, there's a whole West Africa section they've got with a documentary about Ousmane Sembene, which I would say watch that first and then that'll tip you to films that he made that are also featured in that section.
Apichat Pong Wirasethakun.
Is he on Filmstruck?
Oh, yes.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. There's a documentary about him.
Oh, that's right. And, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a documentary about Ozu. You know, you might check that out and see which of his films you want to check out. There's on Criterion Channel, there's a thing about Cannes 68 and sort of the films of 68 and how everything was changing. I'm a big fan of Richard Lester's Petulia, which is one of the films in there. And then they've got like Rafifi and...
Ooh, Rafifi!
Yeah, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, a lot of great sort of European films. Keep an eye out for, I think on Criterion Channel, or maybe Filmstruck, I forget. Anyway, April Wolf, who you know from Switchblade Sisters and Who Shot You, has a sit-down interview with Kelly Reichardt, who's one of our favorite directors right now. And I got a thing coming up in June that I still can't tell you about, but I can very soon, and I will when I can do that.
Mr. Alonso Duralde is going to be doing some Filmstruck-y things in June.
Yes, so keep an eye out for that, too.
Here's a message from Chuck. We won't call it a letter. It's a statement, really.
Mm-hmm.
Winter effing Mitchell. And I think you all understand that.
That's right.
If you listened to the episode where our lovely Pop Rocket friend, Winter Mitchell, was our guest, then you know that she had
things to say.
Winter effing Mitchell.
That's right. Yes.
Alfonso says,
yes,
Paris Hilton. In February, she appeared on the Grand Tour. Actually, Grandpa needs his readers. Let me put my glasses on here. There we go. In February, she appeared on the Grand Tour, the Amazon Prime car show featuring the former stars of the UK hit Top Gear, which itself is now hosted by Matt LeBlanc. My Ukrainian millennial wife sadistically made me sit through TV coverage of Paris's appearance at a hotel opening in Odessa with her fiancé, who is part Ukrainian. And on top of that, I have to hear about her from you guys. What were we talking about?
I don't remember. It was in the winter episode. We somehow started talking
Paris Hilton. House of Wax or something?
Who knows?
I don't even remember talking about Paris Hilton. The Hottie and the Naughty, maybe?
Who can say?
Listen, she's terrible.
Yes.
Okay. Please, David Alonso, don't mention her again. Okay. Unless she cures cancer or appears on Wendy Williamson. Otherwise, thank you for your podcast.
Duly noted. It's a sacrifice we can live with.
Oh, look. More Winter Mitchell. Dr. Steve.
Yes?
Who is a doctor.
He is a doctor.
Thank you for having Winter Mitchell as a guest. She was able to confirm two things for me. First, I left Ready Player One wondering how anyone under age 50 could catch half the 80s references. It was very enlightening to hear Winter explain how and why she has her own nostalgia for the 80s, even though she is younger. I was also glad to hear that I am not the only African-American out there who is simply done with Tyler Perry movies. I still subscribe to the belief that, as someone else put it, Tyler Perry's typewriter has set black folks back two generations. I'm not sure Winter's feelings are exactly the same, but I feel better knowing that she's pretty much done with him, too.
Yes, that was also our acrimony episode.
Yep. Hey, we got a 5-star review.
We do.
On iTunes, or what's it called now?
Apple Podcasts.
Apple Podcasts. All right.
And if you haven't left us a 5-star review yet,
number
you
one,
oughta.
Get out there and do it.
We'll
number
read
two,
it on the show.
Don't bring me any 4 stars or 3 stars.
5.
5. Only 5. Don't step to me with less. All right? I'm watching you.
What's the review say?
It's from NK at pointy thing. Those are the symbols after NK.
Okay. Oh, is it like N cat and maybe that's an ear or something?
Maybe. While the episodes are labeled in iTunes with the usually Hollywood-esque films discussed, and anyone interested can find fair, entertaining, and informed reviews of those films here, the discussion is also usually peppered with references to independent, foreign, and arthouse films. While I don't care about most Hollywood films, this podcast still satisfies
Yay.
All my art cinema talk cravings. So, don't miss out just because you think you don't want to listen to dudes talking about Rampage and Dwayne Johnson and the like. This is good stuff.
Ah, well, thank
so,
you.
So, his 5-star review is directed at people very much like myself, whose jam is the art house and foreign language film and art film, and who think they don't want to hear about us talk about Rampage.
But they would be wrong.
If you don't listen to us talk about Rampage, how are you going to listen to us talk about
Uncle Boon Me?
Uncle Boon Me, for example. Or Western. Or Let the Sunshine In.
Right.
How you going to do that?
How? Yeah. How, we ask you.
The world is a big place. There's so much film out there. The podcasts that don't talk about art house, I don't know why they exist. Frankly. No, we have people who talk about art house. We have friends who host podcasts that don't talk about art house. We don't care. It's fine.
So there's room for everybody.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, do you like what you're hearing? Do you want to hear?
Not really. Oh, you're asking them.
Yes.
Okay.
Do you want to hear more like what you're hearing?
Maybe.
You should check out our Patreon page. Our Patreon subscribers get oodles, I tell you, of extra content. Shows like
premium content.
Shows like LKTV, a podcast of the television.
Quality premium content.
Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by 2 film critics. Or Linoleum Nights, where we curse and talk about complicated
stuff.
It's subjects.
Not degrading to talk about what we do as content at all. Content.
Yes, content. Is that a bad thing?
Yeah, it is.
Have we decided that's a bad thing now?
Oh, it's always been a bad thing.
Fine.
But it's funny to say.
More shows.
Content.
More palaver. More convos. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Also, prizes. And hangouts and all kinds of things.
Yep.
So if you are not subscribing, you're missing out. If you are not subscribing, you are not a club member. And you want to be a club member. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Check it out. Join us. Be there. Thank you all for listening. As always, check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com and check out Cancel Too Soon with Bibbs and Whitney and their Schmoes No Show, critically acclaimed. And, you know, of course, the main Schmoes No Show always is a hoot. Check out Dennis Ennin with Dennis Hensley and the Comics Canon, All Things Cozy, The Sewers of Paris, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. You can... like we said, review us at Apple Podcasts. Give us those 5 stars and subscribe for free there. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Spotify, Google Play, SoundCloud, CastBox, Podbean, you know, you name it. I can't even keep track of all the places that we stream. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Go check him out at Bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. He has a fun new song called Woo, and he also...
I heard it. It's good.
Yeah. He also wrote a really fun song for Big Frida called Rent.
Oh, that's better.
Yeah. So he is.
I mean, I don't want to, you know, judge qualitatively here, but come on. It's Big Frida.
Anyway,
Yeah.
It's so he's keeping busy. We love him. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at LinoleumCast. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. And am I leaving something out? I keep thinking I am.
I don't know.
Gosh, I don't know. Anyway, we were going to talk about how next week I'm at the Mammoth Lakes Film Festival.
Oh, that's right.
So
you're getting nothing next week because he's gone.
But we'll make up for it later on.
Of course.
You know, because we got to talk about Solo, a Star Wars story, among other things. So, not to worry. We will not be dropping the ball on that one. So anyway, thank you for listening. And we hope to see you again around these parts. And until then,
goodbye.